Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Stephanie Story, whose latest novel, Raphael, Painter in Rome, is now available. And for someone who lived only 37 years, this 16th century painter left a large body of work, particularly at the Vatican. Stephanie, you've written previously of Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, and now Raphael. They all lived in the same era. Did they have a relationship personally as well as professionally at the same time?
Well, personal and professional overlapped for all three of them is what I would say. They were all artists at the same time. Michelangelo and Leonardo primarily lived at the same time in Florence. Michelangelo and Raphael come into contact primarily while they're both working for the Pope down in the Vatican in Rome. But since they are competing, they do know about each other. They are using each other's work in order to better their own work. Leonardo and Raphael, for example, both sit at the foot of the David and draw it in order to make their figures better, learn to make their figures better. They do come into contact. We do have contemporary stories of Michelangelo and Leonardo having run-in on the streets, of Michelangelo and Raphael's very fierce rivalry down in the Vatican. So I would say their personal life primarily overlaps with their professional life. We don't know of any of them hanging out at dinner together, for example, particularly because Michelangelo was not really that kind of fellow to hang out at dinner with too many people.
Was the Vatican for a painter at that time the equivalent of nowadays Broadway for a stage actor or Hollywood for a screen actor?
I love that comparison. Yes, it was the height of what you wanted to do with your life and your career was get down to the Vatican and work for the Pope. And that's primarily because at the time, the biggest painters, I mean the biggest patrons of artwork, had the most money, and the Pope and the Church had the most money to spend on art. So you could create the most fantastic, most over-the-top pieces of art and paintings and sculptures if you were working for the Pope. I may steal that comparison from you. Thank you.
It's all yours. And I've got to think that as these painters are working in the Vatican and making these images of Christian history, for lack of a better term, that really has, and I grew up in Catholic school, those type of images have really stuck in our mind as what these biblical figures who may or may not have existed actually look like. I mean, they're all white. They all have perfect hair, perfect teeth, those types of things. Is that throughout history? Can we kind of trace our images of Christian people back to that?
That's one of the reasons why I think I'm so fascinated by this group of people particularly, and it's the reason why I'm the most fascinated with Raphael, because Raphael's images of perfection, of the Madonna and Child, of these Christian images, are what are in our heads when we think of these ideal pictures. He reminds me of Shakespeare in a way. You know how Shakespeare gave us so many of our cliches in language?
Sure.
I always think of Raphael giving us our cliches and our visual imagery. He created what we today think of as perfect or ideal. Sometimes we even dismiss it. Oh, that's just an ideal from Raphael. But he's the person who created those images for the first time and gave us sort of our images of perfection. So yes, I think the way we see the world and we see particularly biblical images comes from this time period. It's one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated with it, because this time period had such an impact on the way we picture the world still 500 years later.
If you looked at a Raphael painting, how would you distinguish it from other works of other painters in that era?
They're relatively easy to distinguish because, one, they really do adhere to rules of perfection. So when you look at a Raphael, they tend to have perfect depth. Everything's perfectly balanced. The Madonnas, you can check out the Madonnas. They tend to be particularly beautiful and graceful and well-drawn. There are never any issues with foreshortening. There are sort of never any quote-unquote errors in the painting, if you will. The Madonnas all tend to look very much alike, particularly late in his career, primarily because he's using the same woman as his model, one of the loves of his life, Margherita Lutti. she tends to show up in a lot of the pictures. You can actually start to recognize an individual woman. His colors tend to be bright and crisp and clear. He tends to create rounded sculptural figures, but that also have a certain grace to them. So whereas Michelangelo tends to have a lot of angst in his pictures, Raphael's are all graceful and beautiful and flowing. After you spend just a little bit of time with them, you can start to pick them out very quickly, precisely because of this combination of realism, perfection, grace. Perugino and Botticelli also have very graceful figures, but the Raphaels combine it with a sense of realism that no one else had managed to achieve yet.
Your book recounts Pope Julius II and the contemporaneous assignments, Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel and Raphael, the Pope's private quarters. What was that scene like?
That's the scene that I feel like we all know from Michelangelo's point of view, right? And
sure.
It's because of a guy named Irving Stone when he wrote Michelangelo's novelistic biography and then the movie that was made out of it, which focuses on the Sistine ceiling portion. So we all know of Michelangelo down the hall painting the Sistine, his agony and ecstasy over it, cursing at the ceiling. But the reason why I wrote the book I did is I wanted to tell that same story from Raphael's point of view, that they really were both right down the hall from each other, not terribly far. If you go visit the Vatican today, you'll walk through both rooms as you're doing your tour of the Vatican. And Raphael is down in the painting the Pope's private apartment. So he has room after room after room of walls and ceilings to paint, while Michelangelo has this one ceiling. But the interesting thing to me about it was seeing it through the quote-unquote courtier's point of view. Raphael is the great courtier. He loves people, and he's very sociable, and he's trying to do all of the right things socially, whereas Michelangelo is down the hall screaming at everybody. And so to see Michelangelo's angst from the eyes of the guy trying to do the right thing, and then the other thing that strikes me about the scene is we all know what Michelangelo does eventually put on that ceiling. And to be Raphael, to be his greatest rival down the hall, putting paint on the walls, and then having to go down and look at and see what Michelangelo has put on that ceiling, that emotional moment of Raphael looking up and thinking, oh my gosh, now how do I beat that? That's one of the things that drove me to write it, because in other versions of history, you only see that unveiling of the Sistine Chapel ceiling as this great heroic high point. And for Raphael, it could not have been. So that's the piece that comes to mind when I think about them down the hall from each other going at it.
And as you're painting, or as Raphael is painting the Pope's private quarters there, how would anybody know what that looks like? Because I would think at the time they weren't, I mean, you couldn't just walk through the Pope's private quarters.
No, I mean, regular people could not have walked through the Pope's private quarters, right?
Sure.
But visiting dignitaries certainly did, courtiers certainly did. There were people coming in and out and spreading rumors. The other thing that was interesting about Raphael, which I don't go into in terrible detail in my book, is he was very careful about recreating cartoons of the scenes that he was put. So the cartoons are the underdrawings, the designs for the paintings he was putting up. And they usually get destroyed during the making of a fresco because you use them in order to transfer your design onto wet plaster. But he recreated a second cartoon that would not be destroyed during the process so that he could put it on public display so that people who could not come and visit the Pope's private quarters, to your point, he could put it up and more people could see his work and be influenced by his design, not only in Rome, but all over the peninsula. It's one of the most interesting things about Raphael to me is that he was so worried about how other people would see and engage with his work.
He also used drawings from which he painted. So if we were to watch Raphael painting, how would this look? Drawings on the ground and just looking up and painting?
Well, it depends on which style of painting, right? If you're talking about his altarpieces, he does all designs, and then, yes, he would use, so he would design it out on a piece of paper and do very intense drawings, and then he would use those drawings to copy those onto an altarpiece or onto a wood board. So it's sort of like what you're describing. When you're doing fresco, however, you do the drawing, and then you put the drawing up into a wet piece of before you put it onto the wet piece of plaster, you go through and you poke holes on each of the lines so that you can then put the drawing up on the wet plaster and then use charcoal, a bag of charcoal, to pounce over those holes so that the drawing, the lines of the drawing, show up on the wet plaster through those pounced holes of charcoal. So that then, so you are directly transferring your drawing into wet plaster, and then you go up to that wet piece of plaster and you start filling in the designs. And you only do a small patch every single day because you have to get through the entire piece of plaster, the entire section of plaster you've transferred the design to in a single day before the plaster dries. Much of what he's doing during his years in Rome is fresco, the second kind of drawing I was describing, not the first kind. And so those are two different processes, right? One is more for panel or canvas, which he did paint on some canvas sometimes, even though it was early in that process, but primarily wood panel or plaster on a wall.
You write about the relationship between Raphael and his model, and how revolutionary was it to use a female model at the time, or a muse?
You know, it wasn't... Botticelli famously did it, too. There have been a lot of questions about who his models were for The Birth of Venus, for La Primavera, and Botticelli is the generation prior to Raphael. So, and a lot of painters did paint portraits of women. So it wasn't that unusual to use a female model. They did exist at the time. Raphael just becomes more famously amorous with them than any other. Vasari, who was our very first art historian, he writes the biographies of a lot of these great artists, and he's the first person to do so. Famously, tells us that Raphael dies because he has too much sex with his girlfriend, basically, and dies from exhaustion. So the thing that makes Raphael's attachment to his female novels different is that he was a ladies' man, to describe it that way. That he was sort of fell in love, particularly with one of them, with Margherita Luti, the one he uses over and over again. Now, Michelangelo did not use many, if any, female models, and you can tell that when you look at his work of women. He was unusual in that he only used male models at the time.
Was Raphael a religious man?
It's tough to tell about Raphael's religion, and the reason why... He was not a prolific letter writer. We have a few letters from him, but we don't have a great trove of them like we do with Michelangelo. He wrote a little bit of poetry. His father was a great poet. He didn't write a trove of it like Michelangelo did. He didn't keep intensive notebooks like Leonardo did. He drew a lot. So it's difficult to know his personal relationship with religion. I will say at the time, it would have been almost impossible not to be essentially Catholic. And so many of his paintings are devout pictures, devotionals, particularly of the Madonna and Child. I mean, he paints the Madonna and Child over and over and over again. That you have to have the sense that he was profoundly religious. Now, he was not as outspoken about his beliefs in Catholicism, in God, as Michelangelo was. Michelangelo was very vocal about it. We just don't have that same evidence from Raphael. He was such a courtier that his religion, in a way, to me, ends up becoming court life and ends up becoming his relationships with other people and how he's going to behave in not only his home court of Urbino, but in the papal court down in Rome. These guys lived 500 years ago. It's difficult to know for sure or make clear determinations. As a novelist, I get to, right? I get to fill in some of the blanks with what my imagination holds. I don't dwell on Raphael's religiosity in this novel. as much as I did on Michelangelo's in my first novel, simply because he seems to me more obsessed with his paint and his political life than he does with his personal religious life.
It's just an incredible story, and it's one that has not been told really to anybody's satisfaction until now. The book is, that's the novel, it's Raphael, Painter in Rome. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Arcade Publishing. Stephanie Story, just a fantastic novel. I enjoyed it. Not being somebody who knew a lot about the subject at all, I enjoyed it very much, and I thank you for joining me today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for reading and for having this conversation. Raphael's 500th anniversary of his death is coming up, and it's right before publication of my novel, so I'm very happy to have the two things happening at the same time.
Excellent, and best of luck with the novel.
Thank you so much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.